Hello, boys and girls of Be Better. How are you?
Well.
Hello, Mr. Kaplan. How are you?
Tony Avila is live from Staten Island, New York, joining us. Who else?
Me, Jason
Patrick.
Here.
Jason.
Jason, which Jason?
Baron.
Do we have another Jason?
Bryce is here.
Jason Bryce is joining us today. Very nice. Jason
I'm
Bryce.
Here, Tammy.
Hello, Tammy.
Hi.
All right. Hey, stop me when you know what this is. Here we go. What makes the elephant charge his tusk? In the misty mist or the dusky dusk? What makes the muskrat guard his musk? Nothing yet? I'll keep going. What makes the Sphinx the seven wonder? What makes the dawn come up like thunder? What makes the Hottentot so hot? What puts the ape in apricot? What have they got that I ain't got? Nobody knows what that is.
The letter E.
The Cowardly Lion from The Wizard of Oz. Courage. Nobody knows that?
Nope.
No.
Have you guys ever seen The Wizard of Oz?
Yep.
I watched the day it opened.
Okay. Well, next time you see it, you'll recognize that. Because that's the song, The Cowardly Lion. I mean, the Scarecrow sings, I could while away the hours. And then the Tin Man has his song, and that's the lion song. Because the lion doesn't have courage, right? He's the Cowardly Lion. I want to talk a little bit about this word courage. Can anybody here define it before we get into it? What do we mean? I mean, we
the
all
ability.
Admire courage, courageous people. You see movies, the hero is courageous. What do we mean when
I
you
got
say
it.
Courage? Okay.
The ability to act in the face of fear.
That's very good. But is it more than the ability? Because really, don't we all have the ability?
True. Yes. It's action in the face of fear.
Action in the face of fear. So can courage exist in an individual without fear?
No, because if you're not fearful, then you're not really exercising courage.
Very good. So, Tony, can you think of a time in your life that you behaved courageously?
Sure.
Can you think of a time in your life that you didn't, and it kind of hurts when you think about it?
Oh, absolutely.
Any that you want to share? I'll tell you two pivotal moments in my life that if I really sat down for deep psychological analysis, I promise you these two things would come up. One you've heard me talk about, I'm sure, and that is this sales girl named Karen who worked for Jack LaLanne Health Spas who was making $10,000 a month, and they moved me into sales, and I quit that day. And it bothered me. I cannot even put in words how much it bothered me because I left there feeling like a failure. I had never quit anything in my life, and I quit. And I was sitting on my car, and I'm bringing myself back there now, even telling you about it. And I'm thinking, Karen hates people. She doesn't care about anybody getting fit or better. She just cares about money. And she's able to do it, and I'm not. What is wrong with me? Why can't I do it? What am I afraid of? And to this day, when it eats me up. Now, I'm thankful for it because it taught me to develop Navaka. If it wasn't for that feeling, I never would have gone out, and I never would have sought out an answer to how do you sell without offending people. You know, how do you actually sell without being a salesperson? The other goes farther back. I grew up in Bayside, Queens, New York. And when I grew up, the only black people I knew were the professional athletes. We didn't have any black kids in our school except one, Philip MacArthur. Both his parents were doctors, and he sucked in basketball. So we sort of didn't count him. And this is going to sound bizarre, and I'm going to age myself by telling you this, but when I was in sixth grade, they started desegregation. I don't think anybody else is old enough here to remember that. So the schools had to, they bust black kids into white areas so that they would integrate the schools so they could get equal education. And I remember being really excited, and this is going to sound really ridiculous and maybe racist, and if it does, I apologize. We were excited because we were going to get good basketball players. I'm not kidding. Me and Bosic, we were like imagining who the new kids are going to be because we're going to have the best basketball team.
That's some racist shit, but go ahead.
Yeah, is it?
It's okay.
All I'm doing is telling you the truth. And to tell you how racist it was, back then, this is really going to sound crazy. When the day the first bus came in, and they came in from Corona, the day the first bus came in, there were moms, and I don't know whose moms they were, holding signs, like protesting it. So, I mean, this was in the 60s, but this is like, you know, Martin Luther King days, and they thought that was okay. So you look at how far we've come. But we're waiting to, everybody got in early that day because we're waiting for the bus to come. So the bus shows up, and the kids get off from Corona, and they're all like walking to the front of the school, and we're like eyeballing each other, and nobody, you know, says anything or does anything. We're just sort of looking. And the last one to come off the bus is a 6-foot-tall girl. I picture her as a giant. Now, I was little at the time, so I don't know how big she really was, but she was big. She gets off the bus, and she just looks around calmly, and she goes, "Who's the toughest kid in the school?" And everybody points to Tuna. Richard Harvey, his nickname was Tuna. Everybody goes, "Tuna." We all point at him. Just immediately, "He is." So she walks up to Tuna, who is the toughest kid in the school, towers over him, gets right in his face. She's actually looking down at his face. And she goes, "You want to meet me here at 3 o'clock and fight?" And Tuna just backs down. He says, "No." So she goes, "Now I'm the toughest kid in the school." And that was it. And Melinda walked into the school. Anyway, we got Gregory Gaines, who's still my Facebook friend, and PJ. And sure enough, we had a great basketball team, and they became good friends. One day in art class, Mrs. Pappalardo, who could not control the class at all, made a deal with us. She said, "If you kids behave, I will give you jelly beans." So for the first half of the class, we behave, and then she was foolish enough to give us jelly beans. So we start, of course, a jelly bean fight. And I'm throwing a jelly bean at Brett Ulsher, who ducks, and it hits Wilma in the nose. And there's a moment, everybody's laughing, you know, and Wilma just glares at me. So now we walk out of the art class, and we're going back to Mr. Collins' room, and the biggest girl in the school, Melinda, comes up to me, and she says, "Wait in the back of the line." My heart starts pounding. And, like, all of my friends heard it, but they weren't going to mess with it. They just went. Nobody stopped, like, to help me or to back me up. So I'm in the back of the line, and they're sort of cutting me off. So now Wilma and Gail and Melinda have me sectioned off. The rest of the class goes down the steps. And Wilma, who I hit in the nose with the jelly bean unintentionally, winds up and whacks me in the face. Open hand, slaps me in the face, and I went down. And I'm laying on the ground at the top of the staircase waiting for them to crush me, and I just stayed there. And she said, "You better stay there." And I did. I just stayed there, curled up, holding my face, laying there. Three girls. Got my ass kicked by three girls. Not even, just one hit me. I got my ass kicked by a girl in sixth grade. Now, I thought this was the end of me because everybody in my class is going to destroy me. I mean, Phil, you got your ass kicked by a girl. Nobody said a word. Nobody said a word. And after that, we all became friends again. But I want to tell you, laying on the floor, and I know it's a bizarre thing to bring up, but laying on the floor, that feeling of cowardice, man, I felt like a coward. I was in sixth grade, and I just, for the first time in my life, I felt like a coward. And I'm thinking, like, what could I do? I can't hit a girl. It's like a no-win. So I just have to lay here and pray that they don't crush me. So I'm telling you this because when I fought in the Golden Gloves, I think about it now, it was the stupidest thing to do. I wasn't a boxer, but I started boxing. And every single time I faced an opponent, I started fighting at the boys' club. And then I'm into the Golden Gloves, and I fought at Felt Forum by Madison Square Garden. I had four fights in Golden Gloves. Fourth fight, I fought a lefty. I got knocked out. That was the end of my boxing career. I was never very good. I just convinced myself I was. But I just kind of think about that, and I go, why did I do that? I mean, when nobody groomed me to be a boxer, Why was I stupid enough? But you look at, you know, bodybuilding and boxing and all, I really think it was to overcome that horrible sense of being a coward. I really do. And that stays with me to this day. So when I speak in front of medical groups, when I started, man, I had immense fear, tremendous fear. But I wasn't going to lay on the ground. I was going to have to do it. I was going to have to overcome it. Now, I'm not patting myself on the back, calling myself courageous, but I want you to know that if I didn't feel the fear, it wouldn't be such a great achievement. So why am I talking about courage? On September 22nd, I'm speaking to 350 doctors about the ICD-10 codes. Anybody have any idea what those are? You've all read the entire document of Obamacare, right?
Yeah.
Actually, nobody on earth has read the entire document in Obamacare. So a part of Obamacare is there's going to be a different coding system. So you know how when people get a diagnosis, they get a code? As of October 1st, this year, every medical office that's going to accept insurance has to switch over to the ICD-10 codes. I see tremendous opportunity for me, for you guys, and for doctors. But not all doctors. Only the ones with the courage to step up. Most doctors will spend $250,000 in the transition. That comes from the AMA. So understand what's happening. The government is mandating that doctors who want to use insurance as a billing system have to spend $250,000. This is not an investment. It's a cost, pure cost. Why would doctors do it? It's not like there's a chance of making more money. Why would they do it? Anybody guess? I mean, the government says, they don't say you have to. They say if you want to accept insurance, if you want to be paid by the insurance companies, you must switch over to this new system.
But the insurance is their revenue stream, so they don't really have that much of a choice, most doctors at least.
Right. So I look at Dr. Bleiweiss, who most of you have met. He's a friend of mine. I look at his practice. He is busy. He's got now four associates working in his office. Traffic in and out all day. Great staff. I mean, friendly. It's a pleasant environment. They don't bill insurance at all, ever. They tell people when they come in, you can submit it to your insurance company, but we don't accept insurance. Now, what kind of doctor doesn't accept insurance? Can anybody answer that? I mean, most people would say that. What kind of doctor? He can't be a real doctor. What kind of doctor doesn't accept insurance?
One that's sick of dealing with the insurance companies.
Yeah, and you know what I'm going to say? One who has the balls. One who has courage. It's not easy. But when I look at the medical field now, I see doctors without balls. I don't only mean the women. I mean, they're just paralyzed. And for so many years, we have held, you know, these doctors up, and it was the pinnacle of what we look at in the health field. And it's changed. It's really changed. Because years ago, you went to medical school, you did an internship, you did a residency, and one way or another, you were guaranteed a pretty good income. And now you have doctors who were used to earning $400,000 a year. Their mortgage is dependent upon that. Their lifestyle is dependent on that. Their kids' schools are dependent on that. Their car payments are dependent on that. And now the government's coming along saying, you got to spend $250,000 and you probably won't even make more money. As a matter of fact, you might make less. That's the reality. Now, they don't see it that way. They just see it like, oh, we have to make sure that we are abiding with the new change. We have to make sure that we update our software. We have to make sure we train our staff. But when I speak to the medical group, I speak to them very much like I speak to you guys. The opportunity is now, not to bill insurance, is to get people well. Why don't they do that? I'm telling you why. Because they don't have courage. They're curled up in the fetal position like I was when Wilma slapped me in the face. That's exactly what happened. So there are a few. There are definitely a few who step up and go, yeah, I'm going to do this. I'm going to move toward a cash practice. I'm going to start to learn functional medicine. I'm going to stop this diagnose and Medicaid thing and really take an interest in getting people well and identifying the source. Now, you guys aren't doctors, so why am I talking to you about this? Anybody know?
They're going to be in need of my services from what I've
got. Oh, my God, are they. They are so in need of our services. So when we talk about courage, I want you guys to confront it and really ask yourself, do you have the ability to step up and really enter this market? And when I say this market, I'm not asking you to change who you are. I'm just telling you, when I see the opportunity, it is incredible. Let me see if I can pull up my texts quickly. Four people today, this is today alone, and this is in addition to people that I met, because I always do my five a day. It's automatic now. But let me just read you a text or two. Give me a second. Okay, here's one. I have a coworker in her 60s, diabetic, hypertensive, and overweight. Are you still doing the Alive program? Thought it may be good for her. Here's an email. Hey, Phil, it's Melanie from Arvita. Hope you remember me. I gained some weight recently, and Mitch has very high blood pressure and is on medication. Are you still doing that program? I have more. This is just from today alone. My husband saw a nutritionist. This is from a woman that I rented a house from, a vacation house from. My husband saw a nutritionist. The nutritionist knows you. She thinks highly of you, but she recommended that he switch to eating fruits and vegetables and stop eating fried and processed foods. So far, nothing has changed. She's on medication for diabetes and for high blood pressure. Can you help? And here's one more. This is from somebody who inquired about the Alive program but didn't actually commit. Okay, time's up. It's 12 months on Synthroid, no change. In fact, fatter, and my hair is thinner. That's just today. And those are the ones that just come in. So nobody can tell me this market's not out there and hungry. You've just got to step into the arena so they see you as a solution, because I'm telling you this. The courageous doctors will make them well, but they are few and far between. Most doctors will simply give them a code. That's what they do. That's what they're learning to do. They give them a code. So the epitome of courage would have to be the trait that we think of when we think of the story, the biblical story of David and Goliath, right? He felt fear. Of course he felt fear. Look at that David. He's so courageous or stupid. He's facing the giant. No, he felt fear. But he had faith. If we're looking for a modern-day business leader who displays courage, who would you go to? Give me somebody who you think would be in the top 10.
Magic Johnson.
Okay. Who else? Nobody can think of in business? How about Steve Jobs?
Oh, yeah.
Or if we go back a few decades, I'd have to say Walt Disney. Did they feel fear? Yeah, man, they jeopardized everything. If you want to read a good biography, read Walt Disney's biography. There are several of them. But he had nothing at one point, absolutely nothing. For those of you who know Joe Cerulli, he opened Gainesville Health Events. He had nothing, absolutely nothing. Today he takes me out to lunch in his plane. So we can look at stories like David and Goliath, or we can look at courageous leaders like Gandhi or Martin Luther King or Nelson Mandela, and we can become inspired by them. But the mistake comes into play when we look at ourselves and go, well, we're different. We don't have that trait. We feel fear. And as Tony pointed out, we need to feel fear if we're going to behave courageously. Fearlessness and courage are not synonyms. Fear is necessary. Fear and courage are brothers. So when you stay with what's safe and you hear about this, but you fail to take the steps that you know you can take to just wake up this market in your universe so they understand that you can help them, I just want you to think about it. Just ask yourself, are you really being courageous? And I'm not forcing you there. I just know your hearts. Let's make the money secondary. So without fear, there is absolutely no need for courage. Courage cannot exist in an environment where fear does not preside. So I learned that courage is not the absence of fear. It's facing it. Nelson Mandela said, "The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers." And if you did watch The Wizard of Oz, you know at the end they went to the wizard, who was pretty much a fake. But he somehow pointed out that the Scarecrow had a brain and the Tin Man had a heart and the Lion had courage. And what he said is, and this is in the original book, "There is no living thing that is not afraid when it faces danger. The true courage is in facing danger when you are afraid." So I'm going to share this with these doctors. I mean, I really think I want to point this out. Like, guys, you could sit here and listen to me and do nothing. But why? I'm not telling them to change their entire business model around. I'm just saying start to focus on making at least some people well and charging those who are willing to pay to get well enough money. Because who's delivering more value, the doctor who gets people well or the doctor who bills insurance? They're two different entities. Any thoughts or questions on any of that before I go on?
Well, having dealt with some medical professionals and marketing to and creating relationships with, that's definitely on the cusp. As a matter of fact, there's one woman, and she's an Indian physician, and she actually just started doing that. She just totally took herself off insurance, and actually she's my go-to person, and she is thoroughly, thoroughly dedicated to the model that you're talking about.
She's brave. She's brave. And so is Walt Disney, and so was Steve Jobs, and so she will prosper. But they got to have the courage to take the leap. So the only distinction I would make in what Tony said earlier, and he corrected it, it's not the ability to face fear. It's the willingness to take action. So I would ask you guys to take some time and just self-evaluate. It's not up to me to evaluate how courageous you are, or even if it's necessary. But it's a good exercise that I kind of look at in my own life. And if the fear is stopping you, then you're falling short on your potential. So before we leave, I will share with you the 6 traits of courage. But I want to stay with this ICD-10, and then we're going to have Jason in the hot seat, followed by Jason in the hot seat. We got 2 Jasons here. So let me explain a little more about the medical field, just so you fully understand what's going on, because I still think there's this perceived separation between what doctors can do for people and what you can do for people, and there should be. You can get people well, and most doctors can't. And I think you see over the years I've gotten stronger and stronger. I don't know how many of you are Facebook friends with Doug Jackson, but he posted something the other day, and he put a quote of mine from the NSCA Essentials, where I wrote a chapter in psychology, and in essence said, why wouldn't we try to get people well with exercise instead of medicating them? So this isn't new from me. It's just stronger because I live it and I see it every single day. So let's take a distanced perspective from really what's going on. Because I'm telling you, our population is sicker than ever and getting sicker, living longer because they're being medicated, but losing quality of life, and we have the ability to help. So we got to start by understanding, why do people go to doctors? And they go to doctors because they were led to believe that that's where they should go when they have symptoms. Now, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that. There are times you absolutely need to go to a doctor. If you have a strange rash, if something weird happens, if you have a sudden fever, of course you should go to the doctor. But when it comes to these gradual lifestyle-related symptoms, the reason they go to the doctors is because they're insured. That's it. In other words, it seems like a lot of work to try to eat right and exercise and change your lifestyle and quit smoking and stop drinking. But hey, isn't this what they have their health insurance for? They're just going to go to the doctor because there's a copay. The insurance will handle it. When somebody gets into a car accident, they call their insurance, right? Because you have insurance for the just in case. So when you develop health symptoms, you rely upon your health insurance. But here's the real world. Let's say someone has a digestive disorder. They're just uncomfortable. Certain foods are making them sick. They feel very bloated. So they go to the doctor. $20 copay. And they need a diagnosis. So they're diagnosed with acid reflux or gastric reflux. They're given a code and they're given a prescription for Nexium. What that drug does, antacids, that's a category of drugs. Antacids reduce stomach acid. Now, is the problem that their stomach is producing acid? Why is their stomach producing acid? What is it trying to do? What would happen if the stomach stopped producing acid?
You'd have trouble with digestion, right?
Yeah, you can't digest anything, right? So here is this digestive necessity, and they're giving them a medication to stop it, to control it, to minimize it, because they're looking immediately at the discomfort. The person's going, yeah, it just comes up in my throat, and I have heartburn. Okay, we'll give you this antacid, and you won't feel it anymore. So they start taking it. Sure enough, the symptom goes away. Why does the symptom go away? Well, because now their stomach is not producing as much acid. And because that stomach is not producing acid, the valve that is supposed to prevent that acid from coming up into the esophagus weakens. So over time, it is a guarantee that the problem will get worse. It's not a maybe, it's a guarantee. So you can switch to a different antacid or take more and maybe still control the symptom. But in the meantime, what's happening to digestion? They are far less efficient at digesting food. Did the doctor bother to look at what's going on with the flora in their gut? Nope. And that is the root of most issues that reveal themselves first as digestive symptoms. So they're medicated, the symptoms go away, and they're getting worse. Now, this is typical. This is not the rare exception. This is the way it happens. But their insurance pays for the drug, and the insurance paid for most of the doctor visit. So the symptom of acid backing up into the esophagus is gone for a period of time, and the problem becomes worse, and the problem is magnified by the drug that the insurance paid for. What a beautiful system if you are part of a drug or insurance company. You're feeding each other. Now, 2 years later, the same individual who's gotten worse, even though the symptom was reduced, has abdominal pain and rectal bleeding. And the patient, of course, gets very nervous and goes to the doctor's office. So they pay their $20 copay, but this time the doctor notices some oddities. They do a little more of an exam and go, whoa, we got to do some testing here. There's something worse going on. We've got to do some testing. So the doctor says, I'd like to do an abdominal MRI and an ultrasound of some of the internal organs. Okay, now here's where it gets crazy. So he leaves the patient in the office, and he hands whatever he just wrote down to the administrator. What does the administrator do? Anybody know?
Well, that's an insurance chart.
She makes a phone call. Who does she call?
The insurance company.
Correct. Why does she call the insurance company?
Because she's got to get a code and an approval.
And what if she doesn't get an approval?
She doesn't get an approval, then they can't do the service. Or they won't.
Unless
do
the patient does what?
Right. The patient goes away, right?
So an administrator who never met the patient makes a phone call. Phone rings somewhere in South Dakota or Wisconsin or Idaho. And a clerk answers the phone who works for a big insurance company sitting in a cubicle at a call center. And the clerk with the headset on types in some stuff. The computer's in front of her. She scans through codes and she says, nope, the procedure is not covered. Now, she doesn't know the patient. She has no emotional attachment to this person who's bleeding out of their butt. She has no attachment at all. She just says, no. It's not an emotional decision. It's factual. So now the administrator goes to the doctor and says, nope, the procedure is not covered. He would only be covered for abdominal testing if the injury was the result of an accident, and that's not the code we have here. In other words, if he got in a car accident and he had some bleeding and there might be abdominal injuries, it would be covered. But he didn't have a car accident, so it's not covered. If the patient could get on the phone, he might argue the case. He might go, well, listen, this is something that's been going on. But he isn't even aware that the conversation is taking place. The doctor just comes back in and says, I'm sorry, your insurance won't cover it. He's not even aware of the discussion with the clerk. And sometimes it isn't even the doctor who says it. It's a physician's assistant who goes into the room and says, hello, Mike. Oh, my name is Jenny, and I'm the physician's assistant. And it turns out that MRI that the doctor wanted to do isn't covered. So now the patient, who's feeling kind of nervous, says, well, how much would the test be? Now I'm going to tell you a real retail number. For ultrasound of a number of internal organs and an abdominal MRI, in excess of $8,000. For nothing, for no outcome, for no betterment, just for tests. Why is it $8,000? Because insurance pays 10 cents on the dollar. So in order to collect $800, they have to bill the patient $8,000. So if the patient is willing to go forward, he'll probably ask, well, of those tests, I can't afford $8,000. What's the most important? The doctor will say the MRI. How much is that? $1,218. Is this a broken system? I mean, are you guys getting it? Am I explaining it well? Because this is one random example of what happens every day in doctors' offices all over the country. This is not an exception. This is the way it works. So can anybody articulate how you feel about this system? I mean, what if it was a relative of yours? What if it was you? Does it upset anybody? Sure. Or you've just kind of accepted that this is the way it is?
It's definitely frustrating.
So Obamacare comes along because Obama said, we're going to fix the healthcare system, right? Clearly it's imperfect. We're going to fix it. So Obamacare is supposedly the solution. What do they create so that there is a solution? More codes. They went to 2,800 codes. I'm sorry, 68,000 billing codes under the new ICD-10 to replace 2,800. 68,000. So how does that fix the problem? Well, here's the answer to that in their minds. It fixes the problem because now it's black and white. It's not an opinion. They don't have to have that discussion. You could just now pull up the code because there's so many that it's really specific. 68,000 codes. You look at the one, and you can see if it's covered or not by the patient's insurance. That's it. You don't have to call. There's no long discussion. It's just yes or no. Is it covered? So this makes it easier. It makes it more efficient. We can make better choices because we know what's covered and what isn't. The expansive diagnostic codes are intended to smooth billing and assist the population with cost reduction. Is there a problem there? Oh, man, is there a problem there? And it's just amazing to me that the doctors lay down like I did when I got slapped in the face in the staircase. Why are they creating more codes? Because they're going to create more no. Because the insurance companies don't want to pay all these claims. So they're going to say, well, if it's this, it's a no. If it's that, it's a no. If it's this, it's a no. I'm telling you guys, it is crazy. And the doctors are the pawns. So less and less. That's what will happen to the doctor's power to get people well. They'll continue to prescribe tests that are covered and drugs that are covered, but getting people well, their ability to do that becomes less and less. And with that, the doctors will earn less money because fewer things will be covered by insurance. There are more codes, yes, but fewer things will be covered by insurance. So I was looking at these codes because I'm going to do a talk for doctors, and I wanted to just kind of acquaint myself with them. And I found some that were so absurd. These people would be covered if. You would be covered, your insurance would be covered under the code V97.33XD if you are sucked into a jet engine for the second time. I'm not lying to you. This is a real code. If you are sucked into a jet engine again, then the insurance will cover it. You are covered if you are a pedestrian, according to code V00.01XD. If you are a pedestrian on foot injured in a collision with a roller skater for the second time. Why are they creating these codes? Because now they could go, oh no, this is only the first time you were hit by a roller skater. Sorry, it's not covered. There are codes for activities involving arts and crafts injuries. I mean, some of these are so ridiculous. Oh, by the way, there is a code for an injury in a swimming pool of a prison.
Isn't that called the toilet?
There is a code. What's that?
The prison swimming pool. Isn't that called the toilet?
Yeah. There is a code, W55.41KA, for being bitten by a pig. There is a code, W61.62XD, for being struck by a duck. Those ducks are dangerous, man. You stay away from those ducks. So look at how absurd this is. Look at how much wasted effort. What does any of this have to do with getting our population well? And I'm not making these up. These are codes that are in the new ICD-10.
Now, listen, doesn't this really all have to do, I mean, they always use the term Obamacare. And honestly, I find it offensive when it's termed that. It's really the Affordable Care Act. And the instance of it being brought into existence was really to make sure that more people had health care. But it's the insurance companies that came in and did all that damage. I mean, there was no way that it was going to be passed cleanly because it was really going to be going into the insurance company's pocket.
Yes, and let's think about this. Let's say that it really is altruistic, right? So more people could have health care. Let's look at the flip side. The flip side would be fewer people have health care. But those people pay for their health care. They understand the value of it, and they pay for their health care. So the insurance companies are making sufficient money to cover things for those people that would not be covered by insurance for the rest of the population. Okay, so somehow that's wrong because it creates inequality. But aren't we really unequal? Doesn't the person who works harder have the ability to get more things? Doesn't the person who works harder have the ability to get better coverage? So when we try to equalize everyone, what happens? Well, sure, more people can get health insurance, but now in order for the insurance companies to survive, they have to cover less because there's more people. Right? I mean, it's inevitable. There's no way they could provide the same number of covered incidents as they were for some for all. There's just no way.
Right.
So the Affordable Health Care Act, although it sounds altruistic, allows for the insurance companies and drug companies to continue to make money at the expense of not only the people who need to get well, but also at the expense of physicians. It's happening. Tony, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do agree with it. I mean, that's why I find that I think it was started as an altruistic act. I do believe it. I'm not saying that it's perfect, but I think one of the biggest challenges that has been with it has been the fact that the insurance companies have such tremendous lobbies that they're the ones that are in control. And yes, I mean, people are getting less than adequate care, and the doctors who want to do the right thing. I have a couple of really good friends who are physicians. One who's been a client for quite some years, and he retired a couple of years ago. And basically, he foresaw this whole thing and sold his practice. and, you know, just got out of the business. And he always uses the term, I mean, he's 65 years old, he always uses the term, when medicine was good. It's a very different scenario.
And he was brave enough to sell his practice. Smart enough, insightful enough, and brave enough. Because it's really flipping upside down. Now, you know, I've come to know a lot of doctors. I'm not saying they're broke. They're not broke. But when you have a doctor who was making $450,000 and now they're making $220,000, and go back to the scenario I said earlier, their entire lifestyle was created by them to support, to be supported by $450,000 a year, to them it's poverty.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we're seeing foreclosures on these mansions and beautiful homes that were owned by doctors. So, you know, again, the reason I'm sharing this, I don't mean to be on a soapbox, but I want you guys to understand the opportunity, because people will not be made well. People with chronic disease will not be made well by the existing system. It's almost becoming impossible, because the coding and the insurance will cover the medications that the drug companies make money with. And, you know, Tony, if there really were an Affordable Care Act, then, and this makes perfect sense, maybe too much sense, insurance would pay 100% of the bill. Then they wouldn't need to bill $8,000 to collect $800. Right? Like if you get in a car accident and your car is totaled, your insurance replaces the car.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody needs a treatment, then insurance should pay 100%, and then they wouldn't need to escalate those costs by a multiple of 10.
Right.
So, you know, just understand, this is the reality. And I shared those absurd codes because I want you to see how ridiculous it is that people who are being paid in government are sitting there creating codes for people who get struck by a duck to make sure they cover everything. And really, it is a joke. You know, I said this is not a joke, it's real. It is real, but it is a joke. I mean, it's unbelievable that this is really going on. So I applaud the doctors who are courageous enough. You know, Dr. Mark Hyman, Dr. David Bleiweiss, Dr. Hasse. I can count them on, I have enough fingers to count the doctors who are courageous enough. And I think more should, because then they'll be in the business of getting people well. But they cannot do it aligned with health insurance companies and these new codes. They cannot do it. It is almost impossible. So when you look at that and you look at that you have the ability to help people move away from thyroid disease and hypertension and blood sugar issues, man, isn't there a responsibility here? And if there is, then what's holding you back? And that's why I'm asking you to tap into this concept of courage. Okay, which Jason wants to jump into the hot seat first? Okay, then which one wants to go second?
I'll take it.
And then I'll pick the other. You'll take first?
Yeah, Jason Dern.
All right. So, Jason, you got to give us a little summary of what's going on, what your concerns are, what you need help with, direction and guidance in, and then we'll come to your rescue.
Hi, so I'm just watching the game last night. I'm on Facebook. Had an old friend, a colleague of mine, happened to message me out of the blue. Got talking to him, and he was talking to me about his new positions, where he's working at. He's at the NeoUCOM, which is a medical university, and I think it's in Cleveland. I believe he's a director of the wellness center, and he's a executive director of this medical university. And immediately, I'm like, I go, man, I got a program for you. Get me in there. They started talking about a live with him. He's very interested because he's starting to plan out his next year's calendar for his whole center. And he's looking for a 8-week program to run for people, similar to a program that him and I used to be a part of back when I worked at the wellness center that I came from. And I sat there and I texted Phil last night. I'm like, I'm completely drawing a blank right now, and it's creatively frustrating on how to pitch a live to a essentially a wellness center slash hospital. University Educational Center. How do I do this? This is what I want to do. Went through the training. We've implemented in pretty much all aspects of our CrossFit business. We've run at least 20 people through our own, you know, our quote-unquote practice program with it, we being my colleague Bob and I. I had a couple of clients doing it with good success, and I just find I don't know what to say. I don't know. I talk a little about inflammation, about how I can we can reverse inflammation, chronic diseases through exercise and nutrition, get rid of medication, get rid of the surgeries, and he was very excited about it. And I just don't, I don't know where to go next. I don't know how to, and then bigger picture, how to go present it to other hospital-based systems or bigger companies and present it in a very confident manner. So I'm kind of, I'm a loss for words on that, which is not like me when it comes to selling training and selling my programs.
Any thoughts?
Did you talk about how it would make them money?
No, because I don't know how to present that piece yet. Like, I don't know how that would, how I would set that up or give them a package to show that, because I've not done that before.
Personally, I would start there.
Okay.
Okay, so Jason, you say you don't know what to say, right? I mean, that's kind of where you're frustrated.
Yeah.
Like, you want to do this, you don't know what to say. So let's break it down. Number one, here's the question. He has an employee position, right, at an organization.
Yeah.
He's looking for a program. You said he's looking for an 8-week program. So you don't have to sell him on the concept of a program. He's already looking for that, correct?
Correct.
So why does he want an 8-week program? What is the need that he's looking to fill?
I think he's in a newer position with them, and he wants to – my assumption is, knowing him kind of well, I've worked with him for at least 5-6 years. He's looking for a program where he can mirror or bring a – program with this program called Lifestyles at the hospital-based wellness center that I used to work with, and it was renowned for this program. I mean, hospitals all around would know this program because of its greatness, yada, yada, yada. So, like, he's looking to create something like that to impress the people he's with and to make money for the center and to also, in turn, you know, change the lives of the people that are coming there as well, to give them a leveraging position in their and a strategic platform.
Okay, so I heard three things. He personally is looking to impress the people he works for, right?
That's, I'm assuming, knowing him.
Okay, to make them some money, right?
Yep.
And to change people's lives for the better. Right?
Yes.
So let's go to the first one. He wants to impress the people he works for. What would impress them other than money? Because that's the second thing. So what would impress them other than money? What would make them go, wow, it's really good you brought this program in?
I guess how well it works, how much change it does inflicting people with a relatively easy program to follow. Doesn't involve surgery or, you know, medication prescriptions, all that stuff.
Okay. There's more. How about how many people it attracts? Right? I mean, if he has a program but only 2 people sign up for it and it brings results,
right,
then nobody's going to be that impressed. It's also how many people are attracted to it, correct?
Correct.
Now, the next part of it is they want to see a profit increase. They want to make more money, which is what Jason Bryce alluded to. And ultimately, it becomes a win across the board if they do, in fact, change lives. So here's the big question for you. Do you have a program that can bring change in people, that is attractive to the marketplace that would need it, and can make money?
Yes.
So why is this different in your mind than when somebody comes to you and they want to lose fat? There's a need, you have the solution. So here's the need, and you just told me you have the solution. Why is it different?
I think it's just new for me to present it, I guess. I don't know. That's what I'm sitting here laughing. I'm laughing last night. I go, what the heck's wrong with me? I don't know.
I'm telling you what it is. It's fear. And that doesn't make you a weak person, but it's fear. It's something new.
Right.
It's something you haven't done before, and you're afraid. So let's try to figure out what you're afraid of. I was afraid to get up after that girl slapped me. I was afraid to get up because she might do it again, and that would hurt. I was also afraid because I knew I can't fight girls. There's no win here. I can't stand up and fight. So there were specific things that I was afraid of. I was afraid that I was going to be embarrassed in front of my peers. You know, and I think back to that because it's a very real example in a six-year-old mind that carried forward to today of what it feels like to be a coward. So thankfully, I've been able to overcome that again and again and again, but I still feel the fear. So can you identify what things you might be afraid of?
I think number one, not it's not my program and not having enough of my own personal people going through it to give them the results to back
okay.
up what I'm claiming.
How many people went through it with you?
For me?
Yeah.
We had 20 of our members go through it.
Okay.
And I had I've had two personal clients who are currently doing it right now.
Okay.
And then we've implemented a bunch of the...
What percentage of them would you say achieved change, positive change?
I think all of them, but we're looking at different outcomes, I guess. I mean, I know the things that they changed, the things that we went after, the behavioral changes, the lifestyle changes, the intervention, their lifestyles, all of them changed now. What was difficult for us was the cost of the blood tests for everybody, so not everyone can get the blood test. So we only had maybe half the group get the blood test and actually do both tests, front and back. But beyond, I mean, we have a good, I'd say a solid 10 people that are still after what back in February that are still reaping the rewards of the education, the program that we went through. As far as the stress, inflammation, seeing changes.
Okay, so 10 out of 20.
Is 10 enough?
What? Listen, you think 20 out of 20 achieve positive change, right? If 20 is a number, 22.
Yeah.
You think 100% of them achieve positive change. But there are 10 that you say indisputably, I mean, they're just getting better and better and better, right?
Correct.
You show me a hospital program that has a 50% margin. Show me one. It doesn't exist. In hospital programs, 11% of the people put on exercise programs are still with it after 8 weeks. That means 89% abandon the program. So I just want you to stop there. Let's be conservative because you think 100%, but you're not strongly committed enough. So in your mind, 50%, you can stand on that. You know 50% have gotten really impressive results, right?
Right.
That is through the roof for hospital. Now, I wouldn't come in with that, but I just want you to change your belief system because that's where the problem lies, Jason. I don't know that I can give you enough for you to go in there confident. I think you're going to go in there with fear, and you're going to have to force yourself to get over it, and then you're going to surprise yourself with what you can achieve. I think you have more than enough. I think you're the cowardly lion who has the courage already. You know, I just think you need to kind of get in touch with that.
I agree with that.
And everything you said that you are fearful about could also apply to CrossFit. CrossFit's not your program.
Right.
It's just more accepted, so it's easier for you because people heard of CrossFit. Alive, people haven't heard of, but the people who go through it get results. So I think you got to find the courage, and I think you can even say, and be totally honest. Say, look, this isn't my program. This is created by Phil Kaplan. I'm more than happy to talk to anyone you want me to talk to, by the way. The only thing I'm cautious about is sharing the actual data because it's important to me that I preserve the integrity of it. I share it only at select medical conferences. But beyond that, I'll talk about anything related to the program.
Yeah.
But you've got to be able to get in there and just get over the apprehension. And it's not that you don't know what to say. It's that you're afraid to say it. Anybody else? What are you thinking in listening to this? I mean, again, as always, you guys can tell me if you think I'm off base.
So how do I protect if I get the chance to come up there and talk, which looks pretty good? How do I protect it from them taking it and running it themselves?
Well, you're not giving it to them. You're gonna conduct it. You're gonna have a contract with them, and I'll guide you through that process.
Okay. Okay.
But no, you're not handing them a program. I mean, anybody who does the program as a facilitator would have to go through the Aspire program and pass the exam. So you can't just hand it to them. You would conduct it. And how do you conduct it? Hundreds of options. You could hire somebody who is kind of the in-house person. You could be there one day a week. You could conduct the weekly seminars. I mean, there's no limit. You could hook them up with My Alive Across America, and they get trainers through you. And I'll be conservative. I'll say if you get 12 people in a group and you charge them $1,100 each, put a pen to it, and you'll see how much money can be made. If you shared that 50-50 with the hospital, they make more money and you make more money. Is this helping, or are you feeling like, no, Phil, you don't get it, I'm just sort of stuck?
No, it's helping. It's just, like you said, I think it's because it's brand new to me. Like, this is, I've never faced this before. I want to get in this market, so this is,
but you
got to be,
bold enough. You got to be bold enough to get excited about that. Like, I have a program that is better than anything out there that is making change. And I'm going to tell you, we only took 20 people through it because I'm in a different kind of business. Really, I'm working more with a healthy population. But even with that, I took 22 people through the program. They all got results. And 10 got the kind of results that people would die for. I mean, wouldn't die for. would put themselves on the line for. Because it's so exciting to me, and I would love to share it with you guys because, you know, Phil Kaplan, the creator, has been very protective of this. But if we could bring it into this hospital, it is a tremendous program, not for patients. That's not what we're looking for. And I guarantee that's not what they're looking for. For the community at large, because they attract the people from the community. That means they magnetically pull more people in. That's Memorial Hospital's interest in working with me. I'm pulling people in from the community. So what I would encourage you to do, because we're not going to resolve it, you know, on a 90-minute call today, but I would encourage you to get comfortable with the idea that you have to overcome fear.
Yeah.
And then I think you have to practice it. Practice it with your wife. Practice it with your daughter. I mean, she's really not going to object very much. Just practice what you're going to say. You know, call Tasso and just practice with Tasso. Just practice it so when you fumble and you stutter and you make the mistakes, it doesn't count.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't think there's anything I can hand you that's going to suddenly give you the confidence. And it's just like I said with the doctors. It's, you know, I can share only so much, but unless they're going to have the courage to make the leap, I really can't change their existence. And those who do, man, they achieve massive change, both in their own fulfillment and in their ability to get people well. So I put you in that same category.
You helped already. No, this helped already.
Good.
I got to see the words. I couldn't see the words, and I can see the words. I'm better with it.
Good. Okay, anybody else have any thoughts for Jason before we move on to Jason? Tammy, any thoughts? Because I've seen you display quite a bit of courage in your own growth. Anything here that you just found either poignant or anything you think you could share that would be an insight for Jason Barron? All right, Jason, get your butt out of the hot seat. Wipe it down, please.
Thanks, sir.
Okay. Jason Bryce, get yourself up there.
All right. Gross, you didn't wipe it down. You got all that CrossFit sweat on it.
Yeah, I know. That's why we provide extra towels in the hot seat room.
All right. That for you, Tony.
Jason, what's going on with you? Give us the update. Now, here's the update up until this point. You reached a point that you got frustrated, that you felt like, man, you're really trying to help people, you really have a passion for fitness, but you're just not making the money, you're just not getting the professional respect that you think you deserve, and it's just time. It's just time to go to another field, right?
Right.
So update us from there.
I've been in the field another year, and it happens to be the insurance business, but it's the life insurance business. I guess some things had changed, but just getting that field, my view of numbers has changed. Because the time I got out of the field, one of the things that really frustrated me is I went to a local Y, and this is when I was going back and forth. And there's a funeral of a young guy last month. He was but at the time he was a football player. He was a stand-up football player, played for Virginia Tech. And he was a staff member at the Y, a quote-unquote trainer. I call them fitness cleaners because they're always going around cleaning. The actual job is just being a fitness cleaner. And this is when I was debating on whether to try being an employee there for a while to work up. I've been in the field a long time, just really frustrated with the lack of professional respect people get in the field. And one day the guy was talking to a member, and he spent to him about 15 minutes about the exercise program they what they'd done in the past and how to improve, and they said they really appreciated the advice they gave them. 10 minutes later, a manager came up, led him to the office, and they fired him and let him out of the building because they thought he had spent too long without cleaning. And a few things like that and some other things just made me decide I wanted to try another field for a while because I felt like to actually stay in the field the way I wanted to, I'd have to leave the area. My wife was great. I guess one of the biggest shifts I've had since going into the insurance field is the difference in how I see money now. Because at the time I got out of training, even taking somebody through a life for $800, I would kind of wince at the thought of charging somebody so much for the program. But being in insurance where sometimes you ask somebody for $300, $400, $500, $600 a month for the rest of their life for something they're not even going to see the benefit from. It's going to benefit greatly one of their loved ones and not them personally. And seeing the numbers thrown around in different fields, now thought of asking somebody $2,500 or whatever for something that's really going to benefit them. I could do that with help week. But about a month ago, I was approached by my aunt's husband, who's he invests in golf courses. He mainly goes around the country, and he'll buy a golf course, fix it up, try to get somebody to sell it and move on. He approached me about a couple of investors that they're building up a golf course down in Titusville, Florida. I've never been there, but apparently it's slid after the shuttle program was gutted. And he said, would I be interested in maybe getting back in that field? Because a couple of investors are looking at maybe investing in health clubs, maybe have somebody run one. And he said he's talking to you. And it really interests me, but I guess I don't know who these investors are. I haven't met them. I'm planning on going down there on the 28th. There's some stuff that I have to say myself to know more. But I just mentioned a few of the things that, you know, I remembered from a few years ago. I said, well, there is a program. I thought about the unwell market and about how most gyms are targeting the healthy people, really, and the athletes, but nobody's really targeting the unwell market. And if they're looking for something, he said a lot of their business is Canadian snowbirds that come down for 4 months. They got plenty of money, but their health is sliding. A lot of times they can't enjoy the money. And they're also trying to bring in, trying to build the town back up. And I think Lockheed Martin and Boeing and some of the other companies coming in, they're going to have engineers 40 or 60 range. And I said, well, as far as targeting the market that has money, but not sure if their health is going to hold up to actually be able to enjoy it. I corner that and target an unwell market where it's not really being targeted. And they got back one of the investors I talked to. They didn't really want to invest in his golf course, but they were apparently really seeing dollar signs and wanting to talk to me more about the health clubs in the area. And another investor in Orlando's really interested in. They basically wanted me to make a write out a business, detailed business plan and an exit strategy for going in and out as far as doing that. He's got a few spaces down there at the golf course. I want to see him on the 28th. He's already got a perfect setup for the live program. He's got one 1,200 square foot space with showers and a good view to run that from. Something I'm blind about right now, I'm going to have to go out and check the area myself. I don't know if anybody knows the area more than I do down there. I don't know much about the Space Coast. But looking for a potential club to buy out to run and manage a club also. So that's kind of where I stand right now.
Okay, so there's a lot of possibility there, right?
Right, yeah, almost a too many options kind of problem, I guess.
Okay. Now, the first thing I want to tell you, and this comes from a text, and you said it here too, is somebody asked you to create a business plan, right?
Right.
Okay, just so you know, I would charge $25,000. I'm not saying you should, but I'm just telling you, that's what I would charge to do a business plan. So you don't do a business plan for somebody to try to get the deal. I mean, there's a tremendous value to that. And even if you've never done a business plan, you
right.
can contract out other people. So you can pay somebody to get you the demographics. You can pay somebody to help you create a profit model. You can pay an accountant to create some spreadsheets. So I'm just saying there's no reason to give away anything of value if they're going to perceive that there's value in bringing you in.
Okay.
So if they do, in fact, want a business plan, you'll be happy to be a part of that, but not for free.
Right. Okay.
And then I think the other thing that's important is, you know, we talk about the heroes, and one of them is clarity.
Mm-hmm.
You can explore, but at a certain point, you really have to get clear on what it is that you would like to do. So tell me again about this 1,200 square foot space. It is part of a country club?
Right. It's an old country club. Apparently, used to be thriving, went downhill after the space program was gutted.
Mm-hmm.
And he's building the club. My uncle, well, aunt's husband, but probably my uncle, make it easier. He likes to build up the golf courses and then try to get somebody to sell them in around the 1 to 3 year range, or try to get somebody to buy them from him. They're thinking about making part of it. I think Titusville has 65,000 people, something like that, but they're trying to bring more people in. And a lot of who they're targeting, country club, he said, is what he says people come down for Canada during the winter months to play golf and things, but also targeting 40 and 60 year olds.
Would you have to move there?
Yes.
Are you open to that?
Yes, but it, of course, has to be good enough to get me to move down there.
Right. So assuming they pay your moving expenses, just off the top of your head right now, what would you need in terms of salary?
I'd want $70,000 salary at least, but also be able to make more money on the training.
Okay, let me tell you this. $70,000 salary for a country club fitness manager is very realistic.
Right.
That's within the going rate. The obstacle you're going to have to overcome is you've never been a fitness manager in a country club.
Correct.
So somehow you'd need to take, before you work on anybody else's business plan, I would work on just creating, it's not a resume, but sort of a pro forma of what qualifies you for this, not to give to anybody, but it's sort of your homework. You know, just like with Jason Barron, he's got to get comfortable in how to present this. You've got to get
okay.
clear in your head about where your value is, because if you just come in and go, I need $70,000 plus moving expenses to move, they're going to go, well, why are you worth that? And they won't say it in those words, but really that's what you have to explain. So I would prepare by first doing that.
Okay.
And just get really clear. Now, in terms of taking a 1,200 square foot space in a country club and turning it into a profit center, that's a golden opportunity, assuming you have access to people. So they cannot count on you to pull people in from a community that you've never been to at the beginning.
Right, and that's the blind part, because all I've done is my family takes vacation about a year down to New Smyrna Beach, which is north of that. I haven't really, and of course I've been to Fort Lauderdale a few times with the group, in Omaha and watched it twice. I've never really been to the Space Coast, and my just a little basic internet search at the end. When I typed it in YouTube, the first thing that comes up is a couple of smart-ass kids making YouTube videos on how there's nothing to do to Titus Hill, and it's a ghost town after the program got gutted. So when I go down there the 28th, one of the things I have to do is look around to see, like, you know, where these butts going to come from to actually, you know, come to the Hill Club and do the program.
Well, what you figured out is accurate, because knowing you were going to talk about this, I pulled this up. And the population climbed until 2007, and then it dropped significantly. And right now, the population is closer to 44,000.
Right.
The majority of people... But the highest bar on the bar graph for income falls between $50,000 and $75,000. That's not a country club population.
No.
3% or 3.8% earn over $150,000. So this is where you're allowed to turn the tables a little bit. Because if you come in with this knowledge, if you're speaking to investors or developer or anybody or your uncle, you've got to ask that question. You know, you can say, look, I did my homework, and less than 4% of the population earn upwards of $150,000. So how will you attract them? Now, that may not be a terrible thing, because if it's 4% of 44,000 people, but all of them want to be a part of this exclusive country club, there might be an opportunity in that. But you're not going to have those answers. So you're in a position where you can ask back more questions than they ask you. So what I would want to know is, where's your marketing budget? Do you have a person who will do marketing? Is there a way to make the facility available to people who are not members of the country club? You know, I'm just saying there are a lot of questions. So the first thing I would do, I would prepare, if really you're considering this seriously, is almost a defense for when somebody goes, why are you worth $70,000?
Okay.
The second thing is to come up with the questions that you would need answers to, because it's really a two-way dialogue.
Right.
So if somebody says, hey, Jason, can you do a business plan? We think it really sounds good. I'd like to do a live center based on what you said. Can you do a business plan? You have to say, yeah, with a contract. I mean, if they're contracting you, yeah, you could do a business plan, and you could work this out where for the first 3 months you don't move anywhere. They pay for you to come down there once a month. You retain some people to help you put together a business plan and a pro forma. So I just think, you know, part of your excitement about it is just the passion to get back into the field. But I think you have some leverage that you have to develop right now before you pursue anything. So it sounds like there's some real opportunity, but you just have to prepare yourself for it. Does that help?
Yes.
So, in short, you're not ready yet. But you're certainly ready to start putting enough together, so you'll be ready in 60 days or 90 days. And the fact that there's no definitive place yet and no real definitive offer gives you that luxury.
Okay.
Anybody else, any thoughts for him on anything? Everybody went silent?
I'm here.
Well, I do want to tell you, Jason, you've lost your accent completely.
Oh, let's just be the call.
All right. Does that help? Be honest. Because
yes.
If you want more, I'll give you more. But I think that's a starting point for you, is really think about that question. Jason, why are you worth $70,000? Not personally, but to them. What will you bring that makes it worth $70,000? And if the answer is you could bring them $300,000 a year in revenue, that's a good answer. But how? You got to have the defense for that.
Well, and there's one other option, too, that I could, like in the area, they're also – in addition to Titusville, they're also interested, you know, it could be a club anywhere or other places. So that kind of, you know, opens it up if I don't like what I see in Titusville, too.
And is your uncle bringing this to you? He's saying, I have investors who would open a club anywhere?
Right. Like, he brought it up. He said they'd like to buy clubs kind of thing. And like I say, I haven't met these people. You know, for all I know, I'll meet them and see so many red flags. I think I'm in a Chinese airport and not want to go any farther. But assuming they're on the up and up, then, yeah, it was secondhand. Whatever I've told to him, the kind of the same talking points you use for live, the unwell population, nobody's targeting this. Of course, they know all these people that have money but don't have health and have them to be able to enjoy it. Apparently, these people are seeing dollar signs, which gives me some leverage and also my ability to say this isn't for me. I'm going to walk away and stay in the deals because you better believe my wife isn't super enthused about me leaving unless it's for a good reason. So,
are you happy with the money you're making now?
No. Like, I like the money I'm making, and it's building slowly, but it's kind of making money, but I won't go into the details. Some not personal, but some family medical stuff is coming up where might need an increase.
Are you feeling any kind of passion for what you're doing now?
I do some. It's a different way. Now, I will always feel the most passion for fitness because there's the sameness of what I do now versus that is still you get paid on helping people, and it's still about the client feeling they get more out of the relationship than you did. Because you see a lot of people who, you know, somebody dies, but they're able to keep their house and their kids are still able to go to college, and it takes a sting out of it. And so you're still helping people in exchange for money. Oddly enough, my first day of the job there, the first thing we're told is you want to make money in the business, you need to meet at least 5 people a day and tell them what you do for a living.
Well, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
I'm going to write that one down.
Right. Yeah, I kind of, they wondered why I chuckled when they brought that up, because a lot of people seem bewildered at the thought of having to do that.
Right.
So I do like it, but I do like the idea of fitness more. And like I say, the respect is there more now. And of course, that's something that always ate at me, is that now the stereotypical trainer, you know, that they probably don't deserve any more respect than what they're getting. But of course, the kind of trainers are going to be better than the ones really trying to take to the next level. Getting grouped in with people who, you know, are too lazy to get a real job, in some people's eyes, you know, that always eats, I guess, it probably everybody in the county does.
Well, I think you're in a good position because you have an income. You're somewhat enjoying what you do, although it's not your truest passion. And you have opportunity showing up. And I think it gives you an opportunity to kind of take a back seat. And in that back seat, you go, okay, I'm going to work to prepare myself. So if there is a real opportunity here, I'm ready to go. And ready to go and trade the position I've been in for a better position. Because it doesn't make sense if it's not better. That doesn't only mean money, but it has to be better. For you to uproot your family and move, it has to be a better offering.
Right.
I wouldn't move unless you have a 2-year contract if you're being hired.
Right.
So, you know, there's a lot to look at. But again, the question is, why would we give this guy a 2-year contract? He's a life insurance sales guy. Why would we give him that? All right, he's a power lifter, but that doesn't mean he's going to make us money. So as you work on the answers to those questions, you'll be better prepared. And then I'll give you one more bit of advice. Anonymous investors are always red flags. And I'm going to tell you why. They are investing because they think they'll get a greater return than if they invest in the stock market or some other conventional way of investing. So they don't care about you because they don't even know you. They care about one thing. They care about the return on their dollar.
Right.
Now, it's different if you have a billionaire philanthropist who says, I want to invest in helping people get well. But, you know, those are few and far between. So most investors are investing because they expect to get a significant return on their dollars. What I would do, if I really had those investors who I didn't know, I would, number one, get to know them. But number two, if I were in your shoes, I would partner with somebody who does have a medical, does have a medical affiliation, because I don't think it needs to be an MD. I think it can be a progressive chiropractor. I think it could be a naturopath. I just think it would help you in terms of being able to make more money, because the conventional fitness model has been really usurped by the $9 a month, boxes. So it's really hard to get investors to invest in a health club that's going to make money through membership. Personal training studios can well support one owner, but they don't typically throw off the type of money that investors are looking for. But if there is a medical affiliation, and I don't mean an insurance model, but I mean something where you can connect back and forth, even if it's a physical therapist, so there's just a greater revenue production than just the fitness element, that would be attractive to them. So I think I've given you a lot to think about. I don't want to overwhelm you. So can we leave it at that?
Yes.
Okay, so keep me posted. Anyone else? Thoughts, comments, questions? About anything? And Jason, glad to hear from you.
Thank you. Phil, I submitted that Aspire final some weeks ago, and I don't know if you received it or not. It was quite a while ago, when did we go to Fort Lauderdale? It was November. It was probably
that long ago. No, I
should have missed it then. I'm thinking it's probably like 3 months ago, something like that.
All right, do me a favor, send me an email to phil@philkaplan.com reminding me.
Uh-huh.
And I'll track it down.
Okay.
Tony, was this information valuable even as a prospective thing for you?
Yes, it was. It's one of the things I think that I wanted to speak to you about sometime in the near future, because as I get deeper into the relationship with the hospital, and it's kind of difficult crossing that divide. It's almost like, you have a young lady you're attracted to, and then, you see her every day, and you really want to ask her out, and then she becomes, you become friends, and then it becomes awkward to see about, what are you doing Friday night, that kind of thing. So the relationship with the hospital has gone very, very well. We're providing classes for them 2 times a week. So my trainer's doing one day, I'm doing the other, and they have, this free program with the city that's doing the other two. But, I'm at the stage now where, we could have the conversation about, okay, well, let's do the Alive program. And, I'm kind of in a space with Jason right now to say, how would that go forward? Because
why don't you guys connect once a week and have those conversations? Because I'm telling you, for both of you, you have the answer. I know you do, Tony. There's nothing I can give you that will give you that, as I said to Jason, that you're going to go, now I got it. It's just going to come from practice and balls.
Wow.
So maybe you guys can connect once a week. Just set up a regular time.
Well, I don't like Jason that much.
You don't have to like him to benefit from him. Just use him.
Actually, we've been connecting quite a bit, anyway.
Okay, good. And get Velma in there, too, just because it's fun.
Yeah, I don't like Velma either.
You're the one who's racist.
Yeah.
All right, I've told you I would give you the traits of courage. So the first one was you have to be afraid. You have to have fear to have courage. Everyone who is truly courageous faces fear. The second trait is the sense of a need to follow your heart. When you look at people who are courageous, they're not just randomly doing things like mercenaries. There is an underlying mission that is connected to their heart. And every truly courageous hero has a mission of the heart. Third, you persevere in the face of adversity. Every great story of courage had adversity show up. And we've spoken about that in the original Be Better. It's going to show up. It's definitely showing up. The question is, how do you deal with it? How do you respond to it? And the answer to that, if you're going to really display courage, is you persevere. You move forward. You don't stop. Number four, every courageous individual has the drive to stand up for what is right. Now, what is right is their opinion, of course. But they're very firm in that opinion, and they're willing to stand up for it. They're not wishy-washy. They have their perception of what is right, and they have an innate drive to stand up for that cause. Number five, challenging the EEM. Remember, your EEM wants to hold you back. And as you reach greater levels, you do kind of release the limits on your EEM, but then it wants to hold you back somewhere else. And it's important, because if you're too PFC-driven, you're reckless. But if you're going to display courage, you got to challenge that EEM. You got to step out of what your brain is telling you is safe. So it's safe for you to talk to clients about joining your gym or CrossFit or personal training. That's safe. You've done it a million times. Your EEM says this is okay. But now when you start to think about speaking to some medical entity, your EEM goes, no, risky, risky. You might make a fool of yourself. You might not know what to say. This is really bad. Don't do it. And you got to challenge that, because everybody with courage faces that and goes beyond. And the last one doesn't sound appealing until you really start to look at some of your heroes, because it will apply to everyone. And I mentioned Nelson Mandela. Facing suffering with dignity and or faith. When you look at biblical stories, when you look at social activists, when you look at great business leaders who displayed courage, every one of them suffered. Now, that doesn't mean the goal is to suffer. But it's the way they deal with suffering. It's never, poor me, woe is me, let me tell you what happened to me, I deserve more, give me something because I suffered. Never. Facing suffering with dignity and or faith. Anybody watch America's Got Talent? No?
Occasionally.
But you didn't see it like this one just ended?
No.
Okay.
It's the first time I watched it. I thought the swallow guy should win.
What's that?
It's the first time I ever actually watched it. I thought I was thinking the regurgitator would win.
Oh, is that guy amazing? The regurgitator. Yeah, he eats stuff and throws it back up. It's amazing. And clearly it's a trick. I mean, obviously he doesn't really ingest the goldfish and smoke and fire, but I don't know how he does it. It's amazing. As a matter of fact, Jason, if you look at, go on YouTube and look, I think his name is Stevie Starr. He was on David Letterman like 25 years ago. I mean, this isn't a new act, but he's really, really good. So, yeah, I was rooting for him too. But the reason I asked is because on that show, there's a backstory. So they tend to choose for television the stories that are emotional. So sometimes you have somebody who's really talented and probably deserved to win, but it's just talent. And other times, like right now, there's a guy who just came in very close to winning it, and he's a comedian. He's a stand-up comic. My opinion, he's not really that funny, but he stutters. He was hit in the head by a baseball, I think, and there's like this, you know, they play the emotional music and they tell the story, and he stutters really badly. And I heard Howard Stern, who's one of the judges, talking about it. And he says, you know, a lot of them get the vote because people look at them as empathetic and courageous. And, you know, how brave is it for a guy who stutters to get up there and tell jokes? But the truth is, he might have taken the spot away from somebody who's more talented. But we have a soft spot for courage. We look for that. We look for it. So what I'm asking you to do is display it. Because when you are perceived as courageous, you become more attractive to more people. So you are no longer judged by your level of talent, although you certainly should be talented. But when people perceive you as brave and courageous, they want to be a part of what you got. They want to connect. And in your case, if you're getting people well, I'm going to promise you this. Be courageous and others will want to follow. So until we speak again, be better, everybody. I'll talk to you on the next call. Bye-bye.